order this?" And the waiter said placatingly,
I know, it's a gift from an admirer. May I?"
"How nice. Please do. Lotto has a ton of admirers," Mathilde said. "His Hamlet made him a celebrity in these parts. He's brilliant."
"Oh, I know," said Sally.
And Lotto beamed with pleasure, preening, eyes darting around to see which kind soul in the room could have sent along the champagne. The force of his delight such that wherever his eyes landed, the recipients of the gaze would look up out of their food and conversation, and a startled expression would come over their face, a flush, and nearly everyone began grinning back, so that on this spangled early evening with the sun shining through the windows in gold streams and the treetops rustling in the wind and the streets full of congregating relieved people, Lotto sparked upwellings of inexplicable glee in dozens of chests, lightening the already buoyant mood of the room in one swift wave. Animal magnetism is real. It spreads through bodily convection. Even Ariel smiled back. The stunned grin stayed on the faces of some of the people, an expression of speculation growing, hoping he would look at them again, or wondering who he was, because on this day and in this world, he was someone.
"Well, we have champagne," Mathilde said, watching the tiny bubbles flea jump out of the top of her glass. "Lotto and I have an announcement to make."
Lotto looked across the table at Mathilde, blinked, then grinned and turned to his aunt and his sister.
"I'm sorry Mava isn't here to witness this, but I guess we can't hold it in any longer. We're married," he said, and he kissed Mathilde's hand. She looked at him. Waves of heat built in her, one atop another. She would do anything in the world for this man.
In the ensuing flutter and exclamations, the tables closest breaking out into applause, eavesdroppers all, Rachel bursting into happy tears, Sally fluttering her hands near her face, though it was evident she'd already known the news, Mathilde looked for a long moment at Ariel. But he had stood and left the dining room, his slim navy back winking out the door. She was shed of him. For good, she thought. There was a relief like a cold wind blowing through her. She downed her glass and sneezed. A week after graduation, Mathilde was looking up through the casement windows into the courtyard garden where the Japanese maple waggled its leaves in the wind like tiny hands. Already, she knew it. This apartment would be her first real harbor in so many years adrift. She was 22. She was so terribly tired. Here, at last, she could rest. She could feel Lotto to her right behind her shoulder, emanating Lotto-ness. In a moment, she knew, he'd turn and crack a joke, and the realtor would laugh, and a warmth would come into her voice for the first time. Despite herself, despite knowing better than to invest in such young and penniless people, she would take an interest in them. She would deliver a quiche on the day they moved in. She would stop by when she was in the neighborhood and bring them gifts of candy. Oh, Lotto, Mathilde thought with loving despair. Like most deadly attractive people, he had a hollow at the center of him. What people loved most about her husband was how mellifluous their own voices sounded when they echoed back. Mathilde smelled the beeswax on the floor. She heard the neighbor's cat mewling in the hallway, the soft scrape of leaf against sky. It filled her, the kindness of this place. She had to push down the tiny, loud thing in her that willed her to say no, to walk away. She deserved none of this. She could still explode it all by shaking her head sadly, saying they should continue to look. But then the problem of Lotto would remain. He had become, after all, her home. On cue, the joke, the laugh. Mathilde turned. Her husband, God, my God, hers, for life, was smiling. He lifted his hands and cupped her jaw and traced her eyebrows with his thumbs.
I think she likes it, he said,
and Mathilde nodded, unable to speak.
They could have lived on happiness alone in their glamorous poverty in their apartment. They were as slender as fawns with lack. Their apartment was spacious with it. Rachel's gift, the girl's saved-up allowance, was gone in 3 parties and as many months' rent and groceries. Happiness feeds, but doesn't nourish. She tried bartending, canvassing for the Sierra Club, failing at both. The lights went out. They lit candles she'd stolen from a restaurant's alfresco tables and went to bed at 8 p.m. They held potlucks with their friends so they could eat as much as they wanted, and nobody minded if they kept the leftovers. In October, they had 34 cents in their checking account, and Mathilde walked into Ariel's gallery. He was looking at a vast green painting on the wall at the end of the room. He looked at her when she said, "Ariel," but he didn't move. The receptionist was new, skinny, brunette, bored. Harvard, for sure. That gleam of entitlement, the length and gloss of hair. This would end up being Luann.
"Have an appointment?" she said.
"No," Mathilde said. Ariel folded his arms, waiting. "I need a job," she called to him across the expanse.
"There are no openings," the receptionist said. "Sorry."
For a long moment, Mathilde looked at Ariel, until the receptionist said very sharply,
"Excuse me, this is a private business. You need to leave." "Excuse me?"
"You are excused," Mathilde said.
"Luann, please go get 3 cappuccini," Ariel said. Mathilde sighed. Cappuccini. The girl slammed the door when she went out. "Come here," Ariel said. Mathilde's fight with herself was not visible as she neared. "Mathilde," he said softly, "in what world could I possibly owe you a job?"
"You owe me nothing at all," she said. "I agree."
"How can you ask me for anything after your behavior?"
"Behavior?" she said.
"Ingratitude, then," he said.
"Ariel, I was never ungrateful. I'd fulfilled the contract. As you always say, it was business."
"Business,"
he said. His face had grown red. His eyebrows were spiked high.
"You married this Lancelot person 2 weeks before you graduated. I can only assume a conjugal relation. That's not fulfilling the contract."
"I met you in April of my senior year in high school," she said. "If you're counting, I extended the contract by 2 weeks."
They smiled at each other. He closed his eyes and sighed. When he opened them, they were moist.
"I know it was business, but you hurt my feelings very much," he said. "I was not unkind to you. To walk away without keeping in touch, that surprised me, Mathilde."
"Business," she said again.
He looked her up and down. He'd bought these beautiful shoes she was wearing, worn at the toe. He'd bought the black suit. Her hair had not been cut since summer. He narrowed his eyes, cocked his head to the side.
"You're skinny. You need the money. I understand. All you have to do is beg," he said softly.
"I don't beg," she said.
He laughed, and the sullen receptionist clanged back in with a tray of cappuccinos in her hand, and Ariel said, "Sotto voce."
"You are lucky I feel fondness for you, Mathilde."
Louder, he said,
"Luann, meet Mathilde. She'll be joining us here tomorrow morning."
"Oh, goody,"
Luann said, and fell back into her seat. She watched them carefully, sensing something.
"The gallery's employee," Mathilde said as they walked slowly up to the front. "Not yours. I'm off limits."
Ariel looked at her, and she, who'd been with him so long, could see him thinking, "We'll see."
"Touch me," she said. "I walk. That's a promise."
Later, when she was 60 and Ariel 73, she'd hear he was sick. From where the news came, she couldn't say. The sky would speak it in her ear, maybe. The air itself. She'd know only that he had pancreatic cancer, swift and ferocious. For 2 weeks she perseverated, and at last she went to see him. He was on a hospital bed on the deck outside his apartment, all copper and topiary and view. She held her eyes open wide and breathed. He was a droop of flesh with bones in it.
"I like," he rasped, "to see the birds."
She looked up. No birds.
"Hold my hand,"
he said. She considered the hand, but did not. He moved his head toward her. The flesh slid on the jaw. She waited. She smiled at him. Buildings were sun-shocked in the corners of her eyes.
"Ah,"
he said. A warmth moved into his face. The almost joke in it had returned.
"She won't be forced."
"Correct," she said. But she thought, "Oh, you murderous girl, hello. I haven't seen you for so long."
"Please,"
he said.
"Mathilde, take the cold hand of a dying man."
And then she took his hand and pressed it to her chest with both of hers and held it there. What didn't need to be said stayed unspoken. He fell asleep, and the nurse came out on angry tiptoes. Mathilde went into the apartment, sterile and tasteful, and didn't linger at the pictures she once knew too well for the ferocity with which she stared at them, counting the minutes until she could leave. Later, she walked through the cold shadows and blaze of concentrated afternoon light that poured between the buildings, and she couldn't stop. She could barely breathe. It felt too good to be on those coltish, terrified legs once more, not to know once more where she was going. 15. The private investigator her attorney had hired was not what Mathilde had expected. Not the weary, hard-boiled, whiskey-barrel type. Not the soft-haired, British grandmother type. Reading had infected Mathilde, she saw of herself, amused. Too much Miss Marple and Philip Marlowe. This girl was young, nose like a hatchet, shaggy, peroxided hair. An ample display of bosoms, with a dolphin over the top curve of a breast, as if it were leaping into her décolletage. Huge earrings. She was all a bubble on the surface, with a watchfulness beneath. "Ugh," Mathilde had said out loud when they shook hands. She hadn't meant to. She'd been left too long alone, had neglected the upkeep of niceties. It was 2 days after Cholly ambushed her naked in the pool. They were meeting in the courtyard of a Brooklyn coffee roastery, and the wind was in the trees overhead. But the girl hadn't taken offense. She laughed. Now she opened the folder with Cholly's photograph, address, phone number, all the details Mathilde could think of to tell her on the phone. "I don't know how far you've gotten in your research," Mathilde said. "He was the one who started the Charles Watson Fund, you know, the investment brokerage firm. I don't know if you know that yet. About 20 years ago, he started it when he was just a kid. Total Ponzi scheme, I'm pretty sure." The girl looked up, spark of interest in her face.
"You invest?" she said. "Is that what this is?"
"I'm not a fucking moron," Mathilde said. The girl blinked and sat back. Mathilde said, "Anyway, Ponzi scheme is the way to go, and I need proof of it, but I also need more. Personal stuff. The worst you can get. You meet the guy for 3 seconds, and you know he has a closet full of skeletons. Possibly literal ones. He's a fat, shithead, puckered asshole sniffer, and I want to flay him alive." She smiled sunnily. The girl considered Mathilde. She said,
"I'm good enough that I can pick and choose my cases, you know."
"Glad to hear it," Mathilde said. "I don't hire ninnies."
"My only hesitation about yours is that it seems like a personal vendetta," the girl said, "and those get sticky."
"Oh, well, murder's too easy," Mathilde said. The girl smiled and said,
"I like a bit of spunk in a lady."
"But I'm no lady," Mathilde said, already tired of this strange flirtation, drinking her coffee down so that she could go. Mathilde stood, and the girl said, "Wait." She pulled the arms of her shirt through the sleeves and turned it around so the low collar was in the back, now crisp-looking, professional. She pulled off her shaggy wig to show brown hair cut boyishly short. She took off the earrings, the false eyelashes. She was a different person, severe and sharp. She looked like the only female grad student at a math department mixer.
"That was some Bond-level disguise craft," Mathilde said.
"Hilarious. I bet it usually seals the deal for you."
"Usually," the investigator said. She seemed abashed.
"And the boob dolphin," Mathilde said.
"I had a stupid youth," the girl said.
"We have all had stupid youths," said Mathilde. "I find them delicious."
They smiled at each other across the table freckled with pollen.
"All right, you'll do," Mathilde said.
"Honey, I'll more than do," the girl said, and leaned forward and touched Mathilde's hand just long enough to make her meaning clear.
"Anger's my meat, I sup upon myself, and so shall starve with feeding."
Volumnia says this in Shakespeare's Coriolanus. She, steely, controlling, is far more interesting than Coriolanus. Alas, nobody would go to see a play called Volumnia.
16. The clouds had descended, though the day through the window gleamed with sunlight. She was new to her internet company. It was a dating site that would later be sold for $1 billion. She'd been at the gallery for 3 years. Every morning she would take a breath on the sidewalk, shut her eyes, steel herself to walk in. All day she'd feel Ariel looking at her. She did her job. She took care of the artists, calming them, sending them birthday gifts.
"My prodigy," Ariel would say, introducing her. "One day Mathilde will run the show."
Luann's face pinched every time he said so, and the day came when a jittery artist flew in from Santa Fe, and Ariel and he went out for a long dinner, and when they came back, Mathilde was still in the dark in the back office, writing catalog copy for an exhibit. She looked up, froze. Ariel was in the door, watching her. He came close, closer. He put his hands on her shoulders and began massaging. He pressed himself to her back. After so long waiting for the end, she was obscurely disappointed in his lapse of taste, an unexpectedly gross gesture, frottage. She stood and said, "I'm done," and walked past Luann, who'd been watching from the front, and took all her sick leave at once and found a new job in days without ever telling Ariel she was leaving the gallery for good. But this morning, Mathilde could not keep her eyes on her work. She begged off in her boss's office, and he watched her go with his eyes narrowed behind his glasses, his mouth in a sour twist. In the park, the maple leaves had a sheen to them, as if gilded at the vein. She walked so far, was so lost, that when she came home her knees felt jellied. There was a bitterness on the back of her tongue. She took a stick from the 20-pack she kept in her terror beneath the towels, pissed on it, waited, drank an entire Nalgene of water, did it again and again and again, and every time the patient stick told her yes. Plus sign. You're cooked. She shoved the wands into a bag, put the bag as deep in the trash can as she could. She heard Lotto come in and ran her eyes under cold water.
"Hey, baby," she called out. "How was your day?"
He clattered around, talking about an audition, some mean little bit in a commercial. He didn't even want it. It was humiliating. But he saw that boy from that television show in the late 70s, the one with the cowlick and weird ears, remember? She dried her face, finger-brushed her hair, practiced her smile until it wasn't so ferocious. She came out, still in her coat, and said, "I'm just off to pick up a pizza." And he said,
"Mediterranean?"
And she said,
yep.
And he said,
I adore you with all the marrow in my bones.
Me too,
she said, with her back turned. She closed their front door and sank down on the steps that led to the lady upstairs, lay back, her arms crossed above her eyes, because what was she going to do? What was she going to do?
Mathilde became aware of a strong smell of feet. She saw on the steps beside her face a pair of battered, embroidered slippers held together with string. Bet, the upstairs neighbor, gloomed down at Mathilde.
Come along, she said in her prim British way.
Numb, Mathilde followed the old woman up the stairs. A cat pounced at her like a tiny clown. Apartment painstakingly clean, mid-century modern, Mathilde saw with surprise. Walls a high-gloss white, bouquet of magnolia leaves on a table, deep green shine with a luscious brown underneath. On the mantel, three burgundy chrysanthemums burned. None of this was expected.
Sit, Bet said.
Mathilde sat. Bet shuffled away. Presently, the old lady came back. A cup of hot chamomile, a Le Petit Écolier chocolat noir. Mathilde tasted it, returning to a schoolyard, light through leaves on the dust, snap of a new cartouche in her pen.
I can't blame you. I never wanted a child either, the old woman said, looking at Mathilde down her long nose.
There were crumbs on her lips. Mathilde blinked.
In my day, we didn't know anything. Didn't live in a time when there was any choice. I douched with Lysol, you see. Such ignorance. When it was my time, there was a lady over the stationery store with a thin-bladed knife. Terrible. I wanted to die. Could have, easy. Instead, I got the gift of barrenness.
Christ, Mathilde said. Have I been speaking aloud to myself?
No, Bet said.
But how did you know? Mathilde said. I barely know myself.
It's my superpower, Bet said. I see it in the way a woman carries herself. Many times I have gotten myself in trouble by mentioning it when it was an unpleasant surprise. Been clear to me in your case for about 2 weeks.
They sat there in the long afternoon. Mathilde watched the chrysanthemums and remembered to drink her tea only when it was lukewarm.
Forgive me, Bet said. It must be said that from my viewpoint at least, a child wouldn't be the worst thing. You have a husband who adores you, a job, a place to live. You seem to be almost 30, old enough. A child in this house wouldn't be the worst thing. I should like to watch over a baby once in a while, teach it the nursery rhymes of my Scottish granny. Enity, feenity, figgity, feg. Or no. As I get up a field o' neeps, eh? Spoil it rotten with biscuits. When it could eat biscuits, of course. Not the worst thing.
It would be the worst thing, Mathilde said. It wouldn't be fair to the world, or to the child. Also, I'm only 26.
26, Bet said. Your womb is practically antique. Your eggs are getting all wonky up in there. And what, you think you'd bear a monster? A Hitler? Please, look at you. You've won the genetic lottery.
You laugh, Mathilde said. But my children would come out with fangs and claws.
Bet looked at her.
I hide mine well, Mathilde said.
I am not one to judge, Bet said.
You're not, Mathilde said.
I'll help, Bet said. Don't get your hackles up. I will help you. You won't be alone in this.
Shoot, that took a billion years,
Lotto said when she entered with the pizza. He was too hungry to see her until he'd eaten 4 slices. By then, she had recomposed herself. In the night, she dreamt of things that lived in the dark, writhing blind worms with a pearly gleam, flurries of blue-veined parchment, slick and drip. She'd always hated pregnant ladies, the original Trojan horses, they. Horrible to think that inside a human being there could be a human being, a separate brain thinking its separate thoughts. Much later, at the grocery store, Mathilde would watch a woman swollen to bursting, reaching up for the popsicles on the high shelf, and she'd imagine what it was like to have a person inside one that one hadn't swallowed whole. One that wasn't doomed from the start. The woman looked irritably over at Mathilde, who was gigantic, tall enough to reach. Then her face changed back to the thing that Mathilde most disliked about pregnant ladies, the reflexive saintliness. "Can I help you?" the woman said, all treacle. Mathilde turned abruptly away. Now she rose from the bed where Lotto lay breathing sweetly in his sleep and took a bottle of rum up to Bet's apartment. She stood outside the door, not knocking, but still Bet opened it in a slattern's nightgown, her hair a gray swirl.
"In you go," she said.
She put Mathilde on the couch, covered her with a woolen blanket, plunked the cat onto her lap. By Mathilde's right hand, hot chocolate with a glory of rum. On the television, Marilyn Monroe in black and white. Bet lay back on the ottoman and snored. Mathilde tiptoed home before Lotto woke and got dressed as if going in to work and then called in sick. Bet, face up against the steering wheel, sitting on pillows from her sofa, drove her to the clinic. Mathilde's prayer? Let me be the wave, and if I cannot be the wave, let me be the rupture at the bottom. Let me be that terrible first rift in the dark. For a long time afterward, Mathilde was clammy on the inside, a grayish clay crumbling on its surface. It wasn't that she regretted a thing. It was that the call had been so close. Lotto was distant from her, on the peak of some hill she was too tired to climb. She moved through her life, letting the days drag her after them. But there were tiny miracles to rouse her. A rose water macaroon in the brass mailbox, in a waxed paper envelope. One blue hydrangea like a head of cabbage on the doorstep. Cold, wrinkled hands pressed to her cheeks, passing on the stairs. Bet's small gifts. Bright lights in the dark.
"A difficult thing," Bet had said in the waiting room. "But right. What you're feeling will slowly lessen."
It would. When Mathilde was 28, her husband left for Los Angeles for a week for a small speaking role in a cop drama, and she scheduled the sterilization.
"Are you sure?" the doctor said. "You're young enough that you might change your mind. You never know when the clock will start ticking."
"My clock is broken," she said. And he looked at her. High boots to blonde crown, the eyeliner she wore those days curved on the outside to make cat's eyes. He thought he saw her, and he believed her vain. He nodded, turned curtly away. He planted the tiny coils in her tubes. She ate jello and watched cartoons and let the nurses change her catheter. It was a very pleasant afternoon, in fact. She would do it again if she had to save the horror. To save herself, she would do it again and again and again and again and again and again and again if she had to. 17. Mathilde didn't recognize the private investigator on the steps of the Met. She was looking for the girl from the coffee roastery in Brooklyn from 2 weeks earlier. Either incarnation, frizzled and dolphined, or sleek and sharp. There was a family of heavy-set tourists, a cashmere-skinned young man whom Mathilde looked at carefully, and a scowling blonde schoolgirl in a kilt and blazer with an overflowing backpack. She chose to sit next to the schoolgirl, and the girl turned to wink at her. "Holy God," Mathilde said. "Body language and all. Gangly legs and attitude. I thought I was looking at my own doppelganger from 30 years ago.
I had a stakeout earlier, the investigator said. I love my job.
You were that little girl with a costume box, huh? Mathilde said. The investigator smiled, and there was a sadness there. She looked her age briefly.
Well, I was an actress, she said. A younger Meryl Streep, that's what I wanted to be.
Mathilde said nothing, and the investigator said,
And yes, of course, I knew of your husband. Knew him, in fact. I was in one of his plays in my youth. The workshop for Grimoire at ACT in San Francisco. Everyone was in love with him. I always thought of him in terms of a duck, you know? Lancelot Satterwhite is to adoration as a duck is to water. He only wanted to be swimming around in a great pool of it, but it never soaked in to touch him, just always rolled off.
Sounds about right, Mathilde said. I see that you did know him.
Maybe I shouldn't say this, the girl said. But I don't see the harm now that he's gone. You, of all people, knew the way he was. But the cast and crew had a sort of bet. Whenever anybody flubbed something in rehearsal, they had to put a quarter in the pot, and whoever was able to seduce Lancelot first got to keep the cash. Guys and girls both. All 12 of us.
Who won? Mathilde said. There was a twitch at the corner of her lip.
Don't fret, the girl said. Nobody. Opening night, we gave the cash to our stage manager because he had a new baby at home.
She took a file from her backpack and handed it to Mathilde.
I'm still working the personal angle. There's definitely something there, but I just have to find it. In the meantime, I've bought us an informant at Charles Watson, senior VP. Sees himself as a noble whistleblower, but only after he amassed a fortune, a house in the Hamptons, ad nauseam. This file right here is the skim off the surface, and boy, does it go deep.
Mathilde read, and by the time she looked up, the street had gone bright with sun.
Holy of holies, she said. There's more, the investigator said. It's pretty dire. There's going to be lots of pissed-off rich people. Whatever the motivation, we're doing the world a good thing.
Ah, well, I've always been suspicious of self-congratulation, Mathilde said. We'll celebrate properly when you hand me the personal stuff.
Celebrate? You and me and champagne and a suite at the St. Regis?
The investigator said, standing. Mathilde looked at her strong, bare legs, the narrow hips, her watchful face buried under all that blonde. She smiled, felt the rusty mechanism of flirting begin to move. She'd never been with a woman. It would probably be softer, less muscular, like sexual yoga. It'd at least be novel. She said,
Maybe so. Depends on what you give me.
The investigator gave a low whistle and said,
Off to work I go.
4 years after Lotto died, when Mathilde was 50, she bought a ticket to Paris. Everything was so bright off the plane that she had to wear sunglasses. Even then, the brightness got in, bounced around her brain like a spalding. Also, she wanted nobody to see how the smell of the place she was returning to ravaged her, made her eyes leak. She had become tiny again here. In this language, she was again unable to be seen. She gathered herself at a cafe outside the gate. When the waiter in the airport brought her the espresso and pain au chocolat in a plastic pouch, he spoke to her in crisp French, even though he turned and spoke uninflected English to the sophisticates at the table beside her. When it came time to pay, she didn't understand this euro business. She searched her purse for francs. In the grainy gray day, Paris overwhelmed her with the scents. Exhaust and piss and bread and pigeon shit and dust and shedding plane trees and wind. The cab driver, his nose besponged by pores, looked at her for a long while in the rearview mirror and asked her if she was all right. When she didn't answer, he said soothingly,
You may cry here, cabbage. Cry as much as you wish. It is no hardship to watch a pretty woman cry.
She showered and changed in the hotel, then rented a white Mercedes and drove out of the city. The roaring river of traffic comforted the American in her. The roundabouts became tighter, the roads smaller. Eventually they were dirt. There were cows, tractors, semi-abandoned villages of a sooty gray stone. What had been so huge in her mind was, in fact, terribly small. The house's stucco had been refreshed, painted white under the climbing ivy. The stones on the driveway were new, creamy, soft-edged gravel. The ewes had grown, were neatly shaved across their tops like boys on the first day of school. The wine grapes in the back twined green as far as she could see, deep into her grandmother's old cow fields. A man a little younger than Mathilde was fixing a motorcycle's wheel in the drive. He had a cycling jacket on and a swoop of gelled bangs cresting over his forehead. Mathilde recognized her own long fingers in his, her own long neck, the same folded tip of the left ear.
"Papa,"
she said aloud, but no, this man was far too young. Into the bay window came a woman, stout, bleary-eyed, elderly, though her hair was dyed a squid ink black. She was wearing a thickness of eyeliner below her lower lids. She peered at Mathilde in the car, and her puckered mouth moved as if she were chewing something. The hand clutching the curtain was red, ragged, as if it had spent a lifetime among the cold guts of fish. Mathilde remembered a cabinet full of ripening cheeses, the overwhelming smell. Blind at first, she drove away. In the little village, the cathedral was embarrassing. A Romanesque pebble, when she remembered it grand, shocking, gothic. The Tabak sold eggs still crotted with chicken shit. It was barely noon and the boulangerie was closing. She went into a salon that was also a pizza takeout and the mairie. When the mayor sat down and Mathilde told her what she wanted, the mayor blinked so furiously she left streaks of black mascara on the insides of her glasses.
"That's... you are absolutely sure?" she said. "That house, well, it has been in their family for hundreds of years."
"It is the only house in the world for me," Mathilde said. The Breton accent came back easily to her tongue,
sturdy as heifers, as the rocks in the fields.
"It will cost you," the mayor said. "They are very cheap, that family, very close with their money."
She puckered her mouth, made a rubbing motion with her fingertips close to her chest.
"I can see myself being happy there," Mathilde said, "and only there. I long to come to this town in the summer, maybe even open up a little antique shop with a tea place, draw the tourists."
The mayor's face loosed with this. Mathilde pulled out the creamy card of her attorney and pushed it across the table.
"Please conduct all business through this man. Of course, you'll get a 5% commission."
"6," said the mayor.
"7, I don't care. Whatever it takes," Mathilde said,
and the mayor nodded, and Mathilde stood, and in leaving said,
"Do your magic."
She returned to Paris feeling as if someone else were steering the car. It had been 24 hours since she'd last eaten when Mathilde sat down at her own table at La Closerie des Lilas. Not the best food in Paris, the most literary of restaurants, though. She dressed in a silver silk sheath, her hair back, her face flushed prettily. When the waiter came over, Mathilde said only,
"It has been a long time since I've been in France. I miss the food like a phantom limb."
His brown eyes sparkled. His mustache gave a leap like a goosed mouse.
"I shall bring you our best dishes," he promised. "And the wine to pair with them," she said.
He feigned exasperation.
"But of course," he said, "would I blaspheme?"
When he set the champagne before her, and the langoustine in its herbed mayonnaise, she said, "Thank you." She ate, her eyes half closed. All along, she'd known Lotto was with her, across the table, enjoying her food with her. He would have loved this night, her dress, the food, the wine. The lust welled in her until it was almost unbearable.
If she looked up, she knew she would see only an empty chair. She would not look up. After the cheese, the waiter brought her a plate of tiny pastel marzipan fruit, and Mathilde smiled up at him.
À la victoire, she said. À l'amour, he said, twinkling.
She walked slowly back to her hotel over the cobblestones steaming from the swift summer storm that had passed lightly over the city while she ate. Her shadow paced beside her. She was able to make it to the bathroom, sitting calmly on the yellow travertine tub, before she leaned over and vomited. She flew home to the little white house in the cherry orchard. The purchase of the house in France took months. On the day the sale was finalized, for a fraction of what Mathilde would have paid, but apparently a great deal more than the house was worth, her lawyer sent her a bottle of Chateau d'Yquem. She called him.
Excellent work, Klaus, she said. Thank you, Mrs. Satterwhite, he said. They were exigent.
Oh, but they're exigent people, she said lightly. Sorry to say it, but I'm afraid I have more work for you.
Of course, that is why I am here, he said.
Now, if you please, have the house torn down, roof to joists, the vines in the back ripped from the ground, all of it. I know it is ancient and against all sorts of laws, but do it so fast nobody has time to know what you're doing, and do it as soon as possible. Only the slightest hesitation. She adored this discreet man.
As you wish, he said.
In the photographs he sent a week later, there was sky where there had been chimney, a clear view to the orchard where the 400-year-old stone walls had been. The ground was a smoothly spread cloak of dirt. It was less, she thought, like looking at a corpse than like looking at the place where a corpse had been buried. Her heart cracked open and leaked. This one had been for her. She sent Klaus a car much nicer than her own. His voice was amused this time when she called him.
The work is done, he said, but not without much screaming and much, much rage. Many tears. I am afraid you cannot show your face in that town at any time soon.
Ah, well, she said, what else is new? She said it lightly, yes. Still, she felt the old beast stirring in her. 18.
You're a pathological truth-teller,
Lotto once said to her, and she laughed and conceded that she was. She wasn't sure just then if she was telling the truth or if she was lying. Great swaths of her life were white space to her husband. What she did not tell him balanced neatly with what she did. Still, there are untruths made of words and untruths made of silences, and Mathilde had only ever lied to Lotto in what she never said. She didn't tell him that she never minded being the breadwinner during the long span of their 20s. Even the poverty, even the skipped lunches and the suppers of rice and beans, even the shifting of money from one tiny account to pay off the most pressing bills, even accepting money from Lotto's little sister, who gave it because she was one of the few people in the world who were truly good. His gratitude for what he thought was Mathilde's sacrifice indebted him to her. She did mind something she never said aloud. She'd wished her husband were better at what he chose to do. All of that standing in line in the rain, going in only to perform a monologue, home again to wait by the phone that rang with no job, sulking, drinking, throwing parties, growing fat, losing his hair, losing his charm, year after year after year. The very last winter in the underground apartment, she painted the ceiling gold to simulate sunshine, to cheer herself up, to give herself courage to sit Lotto down and tell him, gently, the truth, that though she believed in him, he might want to find a career he believed in as well. This acting pursuit was not going to work out. Before she could gather the courage, New Year's Eve came around. He got drunk, as usual, but instead of drifting to sleep, he stayed up and at a white heat wrote what had been sitting on his heart for decades. When she woke in the very early morning, she saw the computer and thought, first, of her jealousy, so assiduously suppressed, of him chatting on instant messenger with some pretty blonde avatar of a sad 16-year-old outcast. She picked the laptop up to read what he'd written, and she saw with wonder that it was a play, and that it had the bones of a marvel in it. She took it into the closet in the bedroom and worked feverishly. She edited, condensed, cleaned up the dialogue, and reshaped the scenes. He didn't remember what he'd written when he woke. She easily passed it off as entirely his. In a few months, The Springs was finished, polished. Mathilde read it over and over at night in the closet while Lotto slept, and knew it was good. But though it was a wonderful play, a play that would later change their lives, nobody wanted to read it. Lotto took it around to producers, theater directors. They took the copies he'd had bound, and nobody returned his call. And Mathilde watched her husband's reborn twinkle dwindle again. It felt like a slow death of debridement, tiny, constant bleeds. An idea came in the form of one of Antoinette's notes, a short article ripped out of a magazine on Han von Mayhen. The art forger who had convinced the world his own wan paintings were Vermeer's, though every Jesus he painted had the forger's own face. Antoinette had circled an X-ray of a fake, where, through the ghostly round face of a girl, you could see the uninspired 17th-century canvas Mayhen painted on, a farmyard scene, ducks, watering cans. Fake lair atop bad base. Reminds me of someone, Antoinette wrote. Mathilde went to the library one weekend when Lotto was up in the Adirondacks, camping with Samuel and Charlie, a vacation that she had planned to get him out of the way. She found the plate she wanted in a heavy book. Gorgeous white horse carrying a blue-robed man in the foreground, a confusion of heads on other horses, a stunning building on a hill against the sky. Jan van Eyck, she'd discovered many years ago in college. When she saw the slide during the class, her heart had gone still. And to think she had held it in her hands in the tiny room under the stairway in her uncle's house. She had smelled it. Old wood, linseed oil, thyme.
"Stolen in 1934, the professor had said. "One panel of a larger altarpiece. It is assumed that it was destroyed many years ago."
He clicked to the next example of disappeared art, but she could see nothing but brilliant fuzz. At the library, she paid for a color photocopy and typed up a letter. No salutation. "Mon oncle," it began. She sent both letter and photocopy in the mail. A week later, she was cooking spaghetti, blending up pesto, and Lotto was on the couch staring at a copy of A Lover's Discourse, his eyes unfocused, breathing through his mouth. He answered the telephone when it rang. He listened.
"Oh, my gracious," he said, standing. "Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Of course. I couldn't be happier. Tomorrow at 9 it is. Oh, thank you. Thank you."
She turned, a spoon steaming in her hand. "What was that?" she said. He was pale, rubbing his head.
"I don't even," he said.
He sat heavily. She came over and put herself between his legs, touching his shoulder. "Baby," she said, "is something wrong?"
"That was Playwrights Horizons. They're putting on The Springs. A private financier went crazy for it and is funding the whole thing."
He put his forehead on her chest and burst into tears. She kissed him on the cowlick at the back of his head to hide her expression, which she knew would be ferocious, grim. When, a few years later, an attorney contacted her on her phone at the theater where Lotto was helping to cast his new play, she listened intently. Her uncle, the attorney said, had died. Carjacking. Crowbar. He'd left his money to a home for indigent mothers. There was, however, a collection of antique Japanese erotica he'd left to her, Aurélie, she said, but I'm not the person you're looking for. My name is Mathilde, and hung up. When the books were delivered to the apartment anyway, she took them to the Strand, and with what she earned, she bought Lotto a watch that would stay watertight to 400 feet deep. On the opening night of the Springs, Mathilde stood with Lotto in the dark. Broadway, to begin so grandly. He'd been dazzled by the luck. She smiled, knowing that luck was not real. The workshops had gone brilliantly. They'd attracted a Tony winner for the role of Miriam, undulant, lazy, simmering, the mother. The actors playing Manfred and Hans, the father and son, were barely known now, but would be, a decade later, marquee names in feature films. There was a smattering of strangers, some intrepid avant-gardists, but, confronted by the director in a whispered tete-a-tete with the dismal advance sales the afternoon before, Mathilde had spent all morning and afternoon on the telephone and had filled the empty seats with their friends. The audience was boisterous and the mood of the theater giddy and friendly before the house lights dimmed. Only Lotto could draw 300 loyalists at the last minute out of goodwill alone. He was beloved, uniquely, deeply. Now, in the dark, she watched the subtle transformation as her husband lost himself. So anxious these past months, he'd become again the thin, too-tall boy she'd married. The curtain parted, and she watched with amusement at first, and then with a warmth that bordered on awe as he mouthed the lines, made faces for each character as the actors came on and off. It became a sort of one-man show in the shadows. In the scene where Manfred died, Lotto's face was slick and shining. Sweat, not tears, at least she believed. Hard to tell. Tears. There were standing ovations, 8 of them, the performers coming back again and again and again, not merely because of the audience's great love for Lotto, but because the play came together like magic, congealed at the moment of airing. And when Lotto walked out from the wings, the roar from the audience could be heard in the little bar up the block, to which the friends who had been begged to attend and who had arrived to find the show sold out had decamped to start their own impromptu party. The glow lasted through the night, beyond the bar's closing, when there were no cabs on the street, and so Mathilde and Lotto decided to walk home, her arm in his, chatting about nothing, about everything, the unpleasant hot breath of the subway belching up from the grates.
"Thonic,"
he said, booze letting loose the pretension at his core, which she still found sweet, an allowance for the glory. It was so late there were few other people out, and it felt, just for this moment, that they had the city to themselves. She thought of all the life just underfoot, the team of it that they were passing over, unknowing. She said, "Did you know that the total weight of all the ants on Earth is the same as the total weight of all the humans on Earth?" She, who never drank to excess, was a little bit drunk, it was true. There was so much relief in the evening. When the curtains closed against the backdrop, an enormous boulder blocking their future had rolled itself away.
"They'll still be here when we're gone," he said.
He was drinking from a flask. By the time they were home, he'd be sozzled.
"The ants and the jellyfish and the cockroaches, they will be the kings of the earth."
He was amused by her, he who was so often drunk. His poor liver. She pictured it inside him, a singed rat, pink and scarred.
"They deserve this place more than we do," she said. "We've been reckless with our gifts."
He smiled and looked up. There were no stars. There was too much smog for them.
"Did you know," he said, "they found out just a little while ago that there are billions of worlds that can support life in our galaxy alone."
He did his best Carl Sagan.
"Billions and billions."
She felt a sting behind her eyes, but couldn't say why this thought touched her.
He saw clear through and understood. He knew her. The things he didn't know about her would sink an ocean liner. He knew her.
"We're lonely down here," he said. "It's true. But we're not alone."
In the hazy space after he died, when she lived in a sort of timeless underground grief, she saw on the internet a video about what would happen to our galaxy in billions of years. We are in an immensely slow tango with the Andromeda Galaxy, both galaxies shaped as spirals with outstretched arms, and we are moving toward each other like spinning bodies. The galaxies will gain speed as they near, casting off blue sparks, new stars, until they spin past each other. And then the long arms of both galaxies will reach longingly out and grasp hands at the last moment, and they will come spinning back in the opposite direction, their legs entwined, but never hitting, until the second swirl becomes a clutch, a dip, a kiss. And then, at the very center of things, when they are at their closest, there will open a supermassive black hole. The next morning, after the glorious first night, when everything was good and the light was sweet and possible, she went out for the paper and a whole box of pâtisserie, pain au chocolat and chaussons aux pommes and croissants, and ate a brilliant almond viennoiserie in 4 bites as she walked back. Once home in their cozy, gold-ceilinged burrow, she poured a glass of water while Lotto rifled through the paper, with his hair a bedhead wilderness, and when she turned back around, his great, lovely face had blanched. He made a curious grimace, drawing down his lower lip until he showed his bottom teeth, for once, perhaps the first time ever, wordless. "Uh-oh," she said, and came swiftly to him and read over his shoulder. When she was finished, she said, "That critic can eat a bowl of dicks."
"Language, love," he said,
but it came out automatically.
"No, seriously," Mathilde said. "What's her name? Phoebe Del Mar. She hates everything. She hated Stoppard's last play. She called it self-indulgent. She actually said that Susan Laurie Parks was failing at being Chekhovian, which is insane because of course Susan Laurie Parks isn't trying to be Chekhov, duh. It's hard enough to be Susan Laurie Parks. That's like the simplest criterion for being a critic, right? Evaluating a work on its own terms. She's like a bitch-faced failed poet who knows nothing and is trying to make a name for herself by tearing people down. She only does pans. Don't even pay any attention at all."
"Yeah," he said,
but too softly. He stood and turned around haplessly for a moment, like a great tall dog about to sink down into the grass for a nap, then went to the bedroom and crawled under his covers and stayed there, unresponsive, even though Mathilde crept naked into the room on her hands and knees and dug the sheet out from under the mattress and slithered up the length of his body from the toes up, her head popping out of the duvet at his neck. But his body was lax, and his eyes were closed, and he wouldn't respond. And even when she placed both of his hands on her bum, they slid off bonelessly in his misery. Nuclear option it was, then. She laughed to herself. Oh, she loved this hapless man. Mathilde went into the garden, overgrown now that poor Bet had passed away, and made a few phone calls, and at 4 in the afternoon, Charlie rang the doorbell with Danica on his arm. "Kiss, kiss," Danica shouted in each of Mathilde's ears, and then, "Fuck you, I hate you, you're so pretty." And Rachel and Elizabeth came in hand, sporting matching tattoos of turnips on their wrists, the meaning of which they gigglingly refused to divulge. And Arnie came and made slow gin fizzes, and Samuel came in wearing his baby on his chest. When Mathilde succeeded in putting Lotto in a nice blue button-up and khakis and dragged him out to his friends, and with every hug, every person who came up and told him earnestly how wonderful the play was, she saw an inch of spine returning to him. She saw the color coming back to his face. The man swallowed praise the way runners swallow electrolytes.
By the time the pizza came, Mathilde opened the door, and though she was in leggings,